Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Here's Democrat Max Baucus yesterday on how he's going to get his health care bill passed.
I just think it's continuing talking, working with, exploring, probing, cajoling. It's just being creative about it.
Well, if you want health care legislation, there's a lot more to do than just that.
Continuing talking,
write it,
working with,
fix it,
probing,
trash it,
exploring,
save it,
cajoling,
quick rewrite it, plug it, play
it's just being creative about it.
Will he get Republicans and rebelling Democrats on board to pass it? They might say he's being a little daft. That's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 17th. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, and also Celeste Headley, our new co-host. She'll be with us on Monday. This hour, we take a look at jobs, where they are, and how far people will go to get them. You'll hear what it takes to win the Medal of Honor. All that and more is ahead. But first, let's talk to Dean Rosen. He was a top health advisor for former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and is now a health care lobbyist in Washington. Dean, does Max Baucus' health care bill have a chance of passing here, do you think?
It certainly has a chance of passing, but it's going to require months of tough negotiations, hundreds if not thousands of changes to satisfy various interest groups and members of Congress. John F. Kennedy famously said that success has many fathers, and if this bill does become law, it'll probably be the Baucus, Waxman, Dodd, Obama, Pelosi, Reid, and maybe Olympia Snow bill before we're done.
That's seven fathers I counted, Dean, and a couple of them are mothers, I think. Dean Rosen, stay with us. We'll continue the conversation with you in a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning in the headlines. There's a special closed-door meeting of Democrats planned today about the health bill Dean's talking about. Senator Max Baucus aims to convince skeptical colleagues liberal Democrats don't like his bill's lack of the public option. President Obama hits the road to sell that health care plan today, or at least his version of it. He'll address a rally in Maryland today. The president is scrapping a plan for a missile defense system based in the Czech Republic and Poland. The Czech Prime Minister says President Obama gave him the news earlier today. Russia has fiercely opposed the SHIELD plans. Italy says its troops will stay in Afghanistan despite losing six soldiers in a suicide bombing in Kabul earlier today. The attack on a NATO military convoy was near the American embassy. President Obama awards the Medal of Honor posthumously to a soldier for bravery in the Afghan War. Army Sergeant First Class Jared Monty died in 2006 trying to rescue a wounded comrade. The medal is America's highest military honor. Tributes are pouring in for musician Mary Travers. The Peter, Paul, and Mary star is dead at age 72 of leukemia. And Connecticut police say they're close to an arrest in the killing of a Yale grad student, Annie Lay. Police news conference is due on that any minute. Wall Street gained more than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens today at 97.92. The S&P starts trading at 10.69. The NASDAQ opens at 21.33. Controversy over Joe Wilson's outburst is still making news, so we want to know why you think it's not going away.
My name is Martina Ripon in Kankakee, Illinois. People are attacking Obama because they are bewildered by his conscience, his competence, and his courage.
8778-MY-TAKE. Email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this morning. Congressman Joe Wilson's You Lie outburst has turned into the latest national debate on race, especially after this.
I think an overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man, that he's African-American.
It's former President Jimmy Carter on Tuesday. It's far from the first time this year race has bubbled up to the top of the national political conversation. Think Jeremiah Wright, think Skip Gates, and the list goes on. You've been weighing in all week on how much race factors into politics.
Sick and tired of y'all giving Obama the devil. I mean, the man is doing the best he can. He walked into a mess. Give the man a chance. I'm glad he's in there because we made history. white man been in there, y'all wouldn't say that much.
And listener Carrie emails us, I think these public figures who were voted in to represent the citizens of this country should not walk around calling 50% of the population racist just because of their party affiliation or their position on a political issue. What does this teach my children? When you don't get your way, call someone derogatory names? Tell us what you think and why you think the Joe Wilson controversy isn't going away at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, yesterday on Capitol Hill, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus ended some of the suspense and finally revealed that health care bill we've all been talking about.
There are honest and principled differences among all of us working for reform, and this package may not represent all of our first choices.
So you can hear there that the sale for this bill definitely needs some work.
I think that by the time the Finance Committee votes on final passage for health care reform, there will be Republican support. No Republican has offered his or her support at this moment.
Well, next week, Baucus will try to convince at least a couple of those committee Republicans to swallow his health care bill. And he has an equally big job with liberal Democrats who are upset that the bill doesn't include universal health care and has no public option. So what is exactly in the Baucus bill? Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and health care blogger for CJR.org, among other things, joins us now from Bethesda, Maryland. Trudy, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we've heard about co-ops. We've heard about lack of universal coverage in this bill. What are the nuts and bolts? What's really in the Baucus bill that's important?
Okay, I'll break it down very simply. The bill will require everybody, or just about everybody in the country, to carry health insurance. And that means that if you do not have Medicare or Medicaid or a policy from your employer, you will have to go out and buy yourself a policy. If you do not, there will be a penalty, and the penalty could be as much as $3,800. The penalty grades up depending on what your income is. In exchange for that, the insurance industry will be required to give everybody a policy, even if they're very sick. As we know, they have been excluding people who are sick from coverage for a long time. And they do that because people who are sick generate a lot of claims and cost them money. However, there's another caveat to this, that even though you will be able to buy a policy, that doesn't mean the policy will be affordable. In Chairman Baucus's bill, there will be something called age rating, and that's a jargon. And what it basically means is that people will pay older people will pay up to five times more for a policy than younger people. And so many experts consider that a proxy for looking at your medical condition anyway.
So it's not that they can't still make more money off of sicker people. Now age is just the substitute for sicker.
Exactly. That's what is likely to happen here.
So what you've described is kind of the grand bargain of this bill, which is insurance companies have to insure everybody. Everybody has to get insurance, but insurance companies can't keep you off the rolls and they can't drop you. And they have to abide by some more regulations too, right?
That's correct.
Well, there's some controversial parts of this bill. People might start hearing about what Baucus has described as a 13% limit. Explain what this means for consumers, how much of your income, if you have a limited income, you're going to be required to spend on your coverage.
Well, that gets to the affordability question, and nobody really knows exactly what that limit is going to be. There will be complicated formulas that will determine how much people at various income levels will be able to pay, and right now they're talking about 13%. That could change. There are many members in Congress who believe that this bill is very inadequate in the sense that it makes people pay a lot of income, they'll have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. The bill does provide tax credits for people, individuals, and as well as tax credits for small businessmen to help them buy insurance. The big question, and the one for the public and everyone else to watch, is what will the level of those tax credits be, and will they be enough to pay for a policy? Senator Wyden was saying yesterday that he thinks that they probably aren't going to be enough, and what that means for the people who have to buy is that they're going to have to dig deep into their pocket to pay for the increasing cost of coverage.
And thanks, Trudy. And, you know, the House certainly thinks it's not enough. The House bill thinks that 13% of the maximum cost that consumers would have to pay, most consumers anyway, is way too high. They want it much lower. So that number is also, well, likely to change before we're done with this. Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review and healthcare blogger for CJR.org. Thanks for bringing us up to speed on the Baucus bill, which is just out. Well, I want to turn now to Dean Rosen, who was the chief healthcare lobbyist to the former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. He's now a healthcare lobbyist in Washington for the firm Melman Vogel Castagnetti. This bill is now going to what's called a markup, where senators will sit around and pass a lot of paper. We're talking dozens, if not hundreds, of amendments in the Finance Committee, dozens of hours of debate, all in a packed committee room with a lot of late nights and a lot of sweat. Dean, you've been there through many of these long, late-night sausage-making sessions in the Finance Committee. Set the scene for us. What are the legislative aides and the senators have to look forward to here?
Well, Todd, as you said, I mean, it's a the bill, when it's finally produced, will be hundreds of pages. There'll be hundreds of changes considered in the form of amendment. And that takes a lot of work, both by the members of Congress and this next committee in particular, and by the staff. There'll be, as you said, probably hundreds of amendments, changes that will be filed and formally debated and voted on. Some of those will pass and change the bill. Some of those will not pass. There'll be a lot of negotiation over the details. Maybe Chairman Baucus will want to take something, maybe he won't. And what
How does this work? I mean, do you get two Baucus people, a Rockefeller person and a Grassley person, pull aside and say, look, we'll give you Amendment 1, 7, and 3, but you got to give us 24 and you got to give us 93?
Well, sometimes it happens that way. Sometimes, you know, what happens is Chairman Baucus may see that he is willing to go along with the concept but doesn't like the details of the way it's drafted, so the staff will go huddle sometimes for hours and pass paper back and forth. And we can't forget also the special interests and other folks on the outside, not only individual people, but employers, device manufacturers, drug companies, pharmaceuticals, insurers, and they all have lobbyists and advocates up there, too, who are working on talking points and press statements and other things.
The lobbyists and the special interests get into the huddle with staff as they're negotiating amendments?
Well, they usually don't get into the huddle with staff, but they may send up over the transom their ideas and say, maybe if you changed it this way, it would hurt us less or help us more. So there's that interaction, too.
You can just see a lobbyist standing like sort of at the bottom of the two steps below the dais, passing paper up to senior staff for the chairman of the Finance Committee. It's a fascinating image. Dean, give us – I want a war story from you. I know you've spent some really late nights in these markups, probably a lot of bad pizza and frustrating conversations. Give me a war story.
Well, there's definitely been a lot of bad pizza. I would say probably my highlight of my late nights was during the Medicare prescription drug bill back in 2003. The final negotiations were happening, and literally it was around the clock. My wife had to go out of town to be with her sister, who was delivering twins, and I had my six-year-old daughter. She slept for two straight nights on the couch of the Senate Majority Leader. While I helped the senators and congressmen and congresswomen and staff negotiate a final deal. I didn't tell my wife about that till a couple of years later.
I bet you didn't. Oh, she's a trooper. Your daughter raised in the throes of Senate negotiation and politics.
That's right. So it can be a lot of late nights, a lot of drafting of paper, and a lot of bleary-eyed staff eating a lot of bad pizza.
Well, Dean, thanks so much for joining us. Dean Rosen is a healthcare lobbyist and the former lead healthcare staffer for former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who was a member of the Finance Committee. And the brave, the curious, the wannabe wonks can read the full text of the Baucus bill. There's a link on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the preliminary Afghan election results are in, but are they trustworthy? More on that later this hour. We'll also talk about how the EU wants to punish banks that pay their top executives excessive bonuses, and they're trying to get the U.S. on board. More on that coming up in just a few minutes.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this morning. Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times, joins us, as she does every morning. Louise, EU nations say they'll call on the world's biggest economies to punish banks that pay their top executives excessive bonuses. The G20 meetings begin in just a couple of weeks, and executive pay will be one of the major topics on the table, we're hearing. What are the latest developments on this?
So we expect that after a meeting today in the EU that they'll put out a statement about bonuses and where they stand on them. Some of the presidents of those countries have already been very vocal about it. Sarkozy from France has kind of led the way, as well as Merkel from Germany. Both of those leaders have called bonuses dangerous and indecent. Gordon Brown of the UK signed on to their views on this only after they kind of watered down the language on capping bonuses. And it's put some pressure on the U.S. to think about how it will handle this at the G20 when they meet in about 10 days.
This is all, of course, part of the populist reaction to the financial meltdown. But aren't the European governments and European economies worried about executive flight to the U.S. where they can make more?
Well, that's part of why this is coming up at the G20 meeting, because if the U.S. and all of the other nations who are there, and which represent 80% of the world's economy, agree to some kind of basic rules about compensation, then there wouldn't be flight risk. So that's part of the point. And another thing that's striking about this, a lot of people are, you know, saying it's executive pay, but what they're really talking about is the pay of traders. So you could have a 30-year-old trader, you know, hardly an executive, but he or she is taking huge risk that could cause harm to the company. And these rules are supposed to apply to that person as well. They have to do with clawbacks. So if the person makes a really risky or just dumb bet that doesn't pan out the next year, you can take some of their pay back. They have to do with linking the pay to how your trades or how your bets go. And there's also some talk about whether bonuses should be limited as a percentage of total compensation. That's more controversial.
All right, executive pay and executive bonuses, part of the continuing fallout of the financial meltdown of Wall Street and London just a year ago. Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times, bringing us up to date on the EU and the G20 coming up. Louise, thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Todd Zwillick for John Hockenberry. That music, of course, means it's time for sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, we've been talking a lot about baseball pennant races this week because mid-September is here and October's coming up, and that's playoff season. But we've got to talk about a different race going on in baseball now. That's the race for MVP in both the NL and the AL, the National League and the American League. Take a listen to this.
Mauer continues to rack up hits in bunches against the Indians, 1-0.
So that's Minnesota Twins Joe Mauer hitting an RBI single on Tuesday as he raised his batting average to .373, which is phenomenal. Mauer's on his way to winning his third batting title. Does he have a chance to beat out Derek Jeter from the Yankees, Miguel Cabrera from the Tigers for MVP of the American League?
So in my mind, Miguel Cabrera statistically, because of his low number of errors, is the MVP. He's leading in every category for the Detroit Tigers, every batting category, and they're in contention for they have a playoff spot and they have a great chance to do well in the playoffs. So in terms of who's most valuable to their team, Miguel Cabrera is that guy. In terms of spiritually, in terms of who means the most to their team, of course, is Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter has stepped into the ranks of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Mickey Mantle, he stepped into history when he passed Lou Gehrig's hits record. And in terms of what he means to the team and to the city, that's Derek Jeter.
Hits record for the Yankees, not for the Major League,
correct,
of course.
Correct. And he also is second in hits in the Major Leagues this year behind Ichiro.
Well, is this MVP award, is it weighted towards hitting? I mean, do the top hitters have an advantage, or do they really look at the well-roundedness of the player, the defensive ability? You mentioned Cabrera's low error count. You mentioned a spiritual aspect. I wonder if the MVP voters and judges really look at that, or is this a hitting contest?
Well, I think the MVP is a question of who is most valuable to the best team. That's why Joe Mauer is not going to everyone wants him, but he's going to win the batting title because he's the best batter in the league and he's got the biggest bat. But the Twins aren't in a position right now, although they've been doing better lately, they're not in a position right now to make it to the playoffs.
Break down the National League for us real quick.
Well, obviously you have Albert Pujols and then the other guy, Florida Marlins, Hanley Ramirez. Albert Pujols is the best player on the best team in the National League, and I find it really difficult to say something else is going to happen. Ramirez has more steals than Pujols, so there's some argument statistically there, but without a doubt, I think it's Pujols.
Is Pujols the best by the numbers, do you think, in terms of errors, batting average? I mean, on paper, does he make the grade, or is it more subjective with
him? No, I think he's definitely, on paper, the better player, and he also means the most to his team in this critical moment. And he's also already won a World Series as well, so he knows what it takes to get there.
All right, we got to look at pennant races here. Giants and the Rockies played last night. What happened in that game? Because we're in the final throes of the regular season heading up to the playoffs.
So it was a picture-perfect night in San Francisco, and the Giants were poised to pull within a game and a half of the wild-card leading Rockies, but that wasn't the case because of Jorge De La Rosa, who became a 15-game winner. He threw 8 scoreless innings, and the Rockies pulled it out. They're now 3.5 games ahead, and they're set to cruise into this next round. But still, the race is really tight, and it's really exciting in the NL West.
Phenomenal. 8 scoreless innings. Did he last the whole game, or did they get a closer?
He didn't. He lasted. He left them with a 4-0 lead, and then the Giants came back in the ninth inning. He scored 3 runs in the ninth inning. So it was a beautiful night for baseball in San Francisco last night.
All right, playoffs are coming up. Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen bringing us up to speed on the MVP races in the American and National Leagues, not to mention a little bit about the upcoming October baseball playoff season, which is definitely my favorite part of the season. Ibrahim, thank you. Coming up, incumbent Afghan President Hamid Karzai won the recent elections, but we'll talk about whether or not we can trust those preliminary results. That's in just a few minutes. And now Femi Okay is just coming in with some of the headlines from this morning. Femi.
Thank you very much, Todd. Doing a play-by-play commentary there. Good morning, everybody. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. In a special closed-door meeting today, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus will attempt to convince Democrats that his reform package is a good idea. He also needs to rally GOP support, but Republican Party Chairman Michael Steele says that the co-ops mentioned in the Baucus bill amount to a backdoor to a public option. I'm quoting him there. Staying with healthcare, President Obama remains dedicated to promoting his overhaul. He'll rally with supporters today at the University of Maryland. He'll also appear on 5 Sunday talk shows and the entire Late Show with David Letterman on Monday night. Moving overseas now, in a major policy shift, the US is bailing on plans for a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. President Obama has told the Czech government that the radar system will not go ahead. And those are some of the big stories we're following this morning. Todd.
Thanks, Femi. We're going to be covering that the missile shield in Eastern Europe in the next 10 minutes.
Okay, that's a big developing story.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, President Obama today will award a posthumous Medal of Honor to Sergeant First Class Jared Monty. Sergeant Monty was killed in Afghanistan in 2006. The Medal of Honor is the highest award for bravery given by the U.S. military. The president will award it today. I'm here now with U.S. Army medic Zachary Barnes on the line from Watertown, New York. He served with the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan. He knew and served with Sergeant Jared Monty. Zachary, how are you?
Good. How are you, Todd?
I'm well. How long did you serve with Sergeant Jared Monty? How well did you know him?
I knew him decently, fairly well. He was pretty much well-known around the whole base by everybody around. And I'd known him personally for about 4 months.
Can you describe to us, please, how he died and what the story is that is leading to this highest honor he's getting today?
Sergeant First Class Monty was eventually killed by RPG and small arms fire on June 21st, 2006, roughly around 7 p.m. His small recon team of about 16 soldiers came under attack by 50-plus enemy insurgents in the Nuristani province, which, more importantly, overlooking the Gardesh Valley, about 2,600 feet up or so. In that early evening hours, they were attacked, and as one position was falling back to a main defensive position, PFC Bradbury, who was carrying one of the machine guns, light machine guns with him at the time, was actually struck and wounded pretty severely. And as everyone else was returning fire and trying to suppress the enemy, Sergeant First Class Monty made two unsuccessful attempts to go out into the open and pull in his soldier, PFC Bradbury.
He tried to run over to him?
He tried to run over and threw basically the main, mainly open area under heavy enemy fire. And on a third attempt, Sergeant First Class Monty was actually struck directly with an RPG and had several bullets just riddle him. And was killed pretty much instantly.
You mentioned Private First Class Bradbury, who was manning the light machine gun. He was the one who was wounded when Sergeant Monty tried to run to him. What became of PFC Bradbury? Did he survive?
PFC Bradbury actually did survive the battle that night. Unfortunately, there was a very unfortunate accident the next early morning when they were trying to take PFC Bradbury out because he was wounded. And him and himself and Staff Sergeant Heath Craig was a flight medic, and they actually both ended up, as they were going up the hoist into the medevac helicopter, the hoist ended up snapping, and they both fell to their death. So it's a tragic end to that.
It is a tragic end.
He survived the battle, but ended up dying in a horrible accident.
And Sergeant Monty saved this private's life, only to have him pass the next day on a helicopter wire.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about your experience on the day of Sergeant Monty's death, what you saw, what you smelled, what you heard.
The biggest thing that we heard, I was actually listening to a radio at the time of the attack. I wasn't actually on the mountain. And as we were monitoring the radio, we could hear Chaos 35, which was Sergeant Monty's call sign. He was calling in for indirect fire, which is like mortars and artillery, and also calling in several thousand pounds worth of bombs to help suppress the enemy away from their position. And there was about a moment of probably about a minute or so of silence where we were all kind of just listening, holding our breaths. And then Sergeant, which we found out later was Sergeant Gruzetsky, came on. It was his different voice. And we all kind of looked at each other, and we knew that there was a reason that Sergeant Monty wasn't on the radio, because he was always on the radio. He was always the guy handling those kind of situations. And I think a lot of us knew at that point in time that something grave had happened to him. We spent the rest of the night. I actually went out on a team of about 10 Humvees and went out to go try to assist the troops, although we couldn't actually get to the mountaintop where they were at. But we were bringing more ammo for the mortars that were nearby that were giving them suppressive fire, and just trying to get a situation held. And we ended up spending up all night with the guys on the radio and just trying to talk to them and keep them alive and everything until we can get to them the next day.
All right, that is the story of an American military hero, Sergeant Jared Monty, who will be awarded the Medal of Honor by the President of the United States today. We've been speaking with Zachary Barnes, U.S. Army medic who served with Jared Monty in the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan. Zachary, thanks for joining us and sharing your story. All right, we'll turn now to Eastern Europe. Some big international news this morning is that the United States is abandoning plans for a missile defense shield in Poland and the Czech Republic. This is a big deal, and it was a major roadblock in U.S.-Russian relations since the Bush administration, when the Bush administration had pushed ahead with plans for a missile shield in Eastern Europe. We're going to get the very latest on the story, including the first official Russian reaction from this. Joining us from Moscow is BBC Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin. Richard, you've got some Russian official reaction to this, not from the Kremlin itself, but from a leading Russian ambassador. What's he told you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're still waiting, actually, from word from the Kremlin. I think they're waiting for Washington to speak, and it'd be some announcement from President Obama or from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. But what we've heard is from, as you say, a senior ambassador, a guy called Dmitry Rogozin, who's actually Russia's ambassador to NATO. And he has used these words. You know, he's saying that this is a breakthrough in relations between Washington and Moscow. And as he put it, it removes a niggling problem which had been preventing real work between the two countries. He was, however, also being a little bit cautious, you know, saying that what has been announced does not necessarily mean the complete end of the United States missile defense program. You know, saying, for example, that they could put these missiles and radars onto warships or in other areas. So some note of caution from the Russians, but generally, certainly from this ambassador, welcoming the decision.
Now, the Bush administration had said for a long time that this missile shield was about protecting Europe and our allies from Iran and from potentially belligerent countries in the Middle East, not protecting us from Russia. But the Russians never really bought it. But this was a major concession by the United States. What do we expect to get in kind from the Russians for this warming of relations here?
Well, you know, obviously that is absolutely the key question. And at the moment, to be honest, we're really not sure. But certainly people here understand that more cooperation with the United States from Russia is expected, in particular on the issue. At the moment, they're in the middle of very intensive negotiations to try and reduce the stockpiles of nuclear weapons on both sides, trying to renew the so-called START Treaty. And there's a very close deadline on that. And the deadline is December, so just another few months to go. And Russia's been dragging its heels on this issue because of the missile defense shield.
All right,
so
well,
I think there's a big expectation that that issue will move on more quickly now.
Well, now the missile defense shield appears to be off the table. The Obama administration announcing it will not build a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. Richard Galpin, BBC correspondent in Moscow, joining us to give us the latest reaction from the Russians. Richard, thank you. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry.
Some of us grow up tall and handsome. Some of us grow up plain. Some of us own the world in ransom. Some of us just our name.
Sad news this morning for music fans. Mary Travers of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary passed away from leukemia at age 72. I'm here now with Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy. He's a Takeaway music contributor, and he joins us from up in Woodstock, New York. Jack, you're with us this morning from a place that was the center of music in the 1960s and certainly a place where Peter, Paul, and Mary made their mark. What do you think is the legacy of Mary Travers?
Well, what Mary really shared with a lot of people was she had an incredible sincerity in her voice that everybody can hear that this isn't a contrived singer. In fact, in her early days, she was too shy. She had suffered from stage fright in her early days and sort of overcame it just by nature of doing it so often. But really where it comes from is Peter, Paul, and Mary were real anchor of the folk movement and helped bring it to a broad audience for the whole nation to be able to digest folk music.
Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of Mary Travers coming to the group? I mean, she was, I've read reports that histories that she was actually hired for the group because she was pretty, which is not exactly what a countercultural kind of folk group would want to have as their
right.
metric for getting into the band. But she had a wonderful voice. What's that story?
Well, it's the short answer. Albert Grossman, who also brought Bob Dylan for the world and the band and Janis Joplin. This was one of his first acts, and he had first started managing. He had the idea around the time after the Kingston Trio came out that a vocal group was going to work really well. He first approached Paul, whose first name really is Noel, to say, hey, he's a comedian, actually, and did acts, and he said, we should do a vocal group, and he flatly turned him down. Then he started working with Peter. And Peter was a renowned folk singer on his own. He brought him to the Newport Folk Festival. And then after that, he finally got Paul to join. And they were looking for a singer. And Mary's picture was on the wall at a music store. And both those guys said, Albert, how about her? He said, oh, now she'd be great if you can get her. And there's an interesting story in that they both say, you know, we never asked Albert what he meant by that back then. And they still don't know. But the short answer is, yes, she was pretty, but she also had an amazing voice and an amazing presence. And at that point, she had already sung at Carnegie Hall with Pete Seeger and done an album with Pete Seeger. So her credentials were very serious already.
Well, Jack, I sorry for this. I realize the times have changed, to quote Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yes.
But I say that because they were very, very earnest, and they sung about important things in social change and social justice. Is there any room for that kind of earnestness in music today, do you think?
I wish the answer was yes. That right now, I think we're so far gone in the pop industry that there's no room for this sort of sincerity. About as close as we get is that there's now seems to be a genre of children's music that is digestible for parents to listen to as well. And in that world, the sincerity still comes through. But in the land of Britney Spears and our favorite person, Kanye, and all this, that right now there is not much room for sincerity.
All right.
Just posturing.
Jack Grace, Martini Cowboy and Takeaway music contributor, joining us to talk about the career, the life, and the death of Mary Travers, of Peter, Paul, and Mary, dead at age 72.
If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Coming up, we'll talk about the lengths people are going to get a job, and lengths is the right word. The number of people moving is on the rise. We're also talking about the controversy over Joe Wilson's outburst during the president's speech to Congress. Why do you think the controversy isn't going away?
This is Scott Berger from Brooklyn, New York. I think the reason that the Joe Wilson controversy continues is there are pockets of America that just can't stand to see a black president.
Is it about race? Is it about they can't stand to see a black president? Or is it about something broader in the racial discussion that's going on in the country with the first African-American president? We want to know what you think. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, Femi Okay is here for a check on the top news stories.
Thank you very much, Todd. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Breaking news just a couple of minutes ago. Connecticut police say that they have a man under arrest for the killing of a Yale grad student, Annie Lay. Raymond Clark is a lab technician at the university. We also got two key economic indicators. They just came out this morning. New home building is up to its highest level in 9 months, and new weekly jobless claims come in lower than expected. There's been a breakthrough in U.S.-Russian relations. That's what a top diplomat calls the U.S. decision to scrap a missile defense system based in Eastern Europe. The Czech Prime Minister says that President Obama told him of the plans earlier. A top Senate Democrat has a tough job ahead, selling his health bill to skeptics in his own party. Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus holds a special closed-door meeting with fellow Democrats today. Some don't like his bill's lack of a so-called public option. Baucus says he's getting criticism from both sides.
There are some who think I've not gone far enough. There are some on both sides of the aisle think I've gone too far.
The Baucus bill will cost more than $850 billion. Now, today, the president holds a rally for his own health care ideas in Maryland. He will also give the Medal of Honor posthumously to a soldier killed in Afghanistan, and that was back in 2006. And finally, staying overseas in Afghanistan today, six NATO troops are dead after a suicide car bomb in Kabul. The attack on a military convoy was near the American embassy. Those are some of the top stories we're following.
Thanks, Femi. Well, we're talking about work as we do every Thursday here on The Takeaway. Today we're looking at the lengths Americans are willing to go to find that new job. Literally, almost 20% of all people, that's one in five, who found new jobs in July had to relocate in order to do so. That's double the number of people who had to pack up and move for a job just last year. Well, Beth Kobliner, our finance contributor, has been watching this number climb, and she joins me in the studio right now. Also, Jeff Gilbert is with us. He spent over two decades working in the automotive supply business. Last fall, he moved from the Detroit area to the the Cincinnati area to take a new job in an entirely new career for a commercial manufacturing company. We're going to get his story too. Beth, thanks for being here. How many people are relocating? The number is, the percentage is doubled, but how many people are we talking about?
Last year it was 1.7 million, and by all indications it'll be higher for 2009. It's an interesting story, though, because at the beginning of 2008, the onset of the recession, the percentage of people relocating was actually at an all-time low, 25-year low. And people were losing jobs, but they were being held hostage by their homes. They couldn't move. They were unable to sell at a decent price or really, you know, get out of that house. So the news is now that people are, it's starting to turn around and people are beginning to uproot their families and move across the country for a job.
So the moving industry, the van lines, and they must be going nuts with business.
Well, the average cost for a cross-country move for a family is $6,500. So certainly that's an industry that's going to benefit.
Is this the people who are moving, are these people who were fired off of their jobs or laid off because of the economic downturn for the most part, or are people making a choice to move in a way that they weren't before?
Right. It's people who have lost their jobs. Look, you know, the statistics are kind of complicated because it seems like when the recession, at the height of recessions, actually people are less likely to move. But as the recession sort of slows down, as it's speeding to indicate that they're doing, people think, okay, I'm ready to take a risk, or I'm desperate, I have to take a risk, and I'll take a loss on my house, and I'll sell and move across country.
Well, a sign of maybe a sign of desperation, or certainly a sign of willing to go further, right, to get that good paying
job. Or possibly
job.
Optimism. You know, people, right, taking a risk is something like, okay, I'm going to go. You know, we're seeing people move from their, you know, leave their families now and go across the country and have their, you know, send the paycheck back. So it's a whole new ballgame.
All right, Jeff Gilbert, over there in the Cincinnati area, you just moved from Detroit for your new job after 20 years. What was it for you, desperation or optimism?
I would say it was more optimistic. We were looking forward to leaving an industry that was struggling, and I was able to obtain a position outside the automotive industry that allowed me to look forward to a better future, I thought.
And what about this average cost of $6,500? How much did you have to shell out for your move?
Well, I had some assistance from the company that I moved with, but I would say that we spent more than $10,000 for the move.
More than $10,000. Beth Kobliner, he spent more than $10,000, even though he had help from the company. Is it common these days, as companies are cutting back, for them still to pay relocating costs?
Not as much. You know, obviously, Jeff was a needed and desired worker, but a lot of times now companies are cutting back. What they are doing, 40% of companies are saying that they will make up the difference between the price for what you paid for your home versus what you sold it for. So that's something to ask for.
That's a huge incentive in this
market. Huge incentive. Yeah. Once you're offered the job, that's something to ask for.
Yeah, definitely something to ask for. How many? Do you have any sense of how many companies are doing that?
It's 40% in a poll of about 250 large companies. So it's something that's out there. It's clearly needed. And if a company wants you badly enough, that's something that they may consider.
Jeff, did you get any house help?
I had some assistance with, I'll say, typical closing costs, but relative to any loss we incurred on the home, that was borne by my wife and myself.
That was all on you. Well, I want to. You mentioned your wife, and I want to ask you about your family. Every single move like this, every decision has implications for the kids and for school, for leaving your friends and trying to get new ones. How has it been on the family, and how are the kids adjusting?
It's been, I would say it's probably been harder on them than me. They're doing well in adjusting. My kids are both in high school, and they've been active in high school, and that's very much contributed to their ability to successfully move into the new area.
I'm curious if you encountered a large cultural change between the Detroit area and the Cincinnati area. I moved as a kid from a big city to a suburban area, and it was a culture shock.
We lived in the suburban Detroit area, and we're in the suburban Cincinnati area, so it's not been as bad.
Suburbs.
From a cultural perspective, it's still very much Midwest values.
Suburbs is suburbs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Great. Well, that's some consolation. You know, Midwest to Midwest or West to West, it doesn't have to be a major culture shock, Beth.
That's right. I'm hearing people move from big cities to smaller towns. You know, college towns right now are really popular. And one of the reasons is they had an experience, the booms, of the economic booms, and they haven't gotten that bust yet either. So cities like, you know, Iowa City and Manhattan, Kansas, and Madison, Wisconsin, those have much lower unemployment rates than the national average.
These are all the college towns?
College towns.
What's behind that?
It's the fact that, you know, that's a business. It's sort of a business that's always there, and they're always going to have to sell coffee to students. And, you know, you sort of assume that's a sort of stable industry within the college town. That, at least that's part of the reason. And also these are places in the Midwest which haven't been hurt as in most areas as hard. So I think it's the college towns. It's also areas with aging populations, rural, older populations like Bismarck, North Dakota, Lincoln, Nebraska, where, first of all, they're desperate for healthcare workers. They need healthcare workers. And
aging population.
Aging population. Yeah. There are more jobs for younger people. So there are places, you know, for a native New Yorker like myself, Bismarck, North Dakota, I don't know where that is. You know, couldn't find it on a map. But for so many people, these are really interesting alternatives that more and more are becoming a reality.
Jeff, real quick, Beth Kobliner, a native New Yorker, would not have considered moving to Bismarck, North Dakota. As a suburbanite, a Midwestern suburbanite, would you have considered moving to Brooklyn, given the chance?
I actually looked at a job in Korea, so I was looking anywhere and anywhere, everywhere.
So you could have moved to Korea, or you could have moved to a foreign country like New York City.
Right.
Exactly.
All right, Jeff Gilbert from outside the Cincinnati area moved after 20 years at his job. He's in the commercial manufacturing business. And, of course, Beth Kobliner, personal finance expert and Takeaway finance contributor, to talk about moving. Thanks to both of you. Well, we're also talking this morning about the Joe Wilson controversy and why you think it's just not going away.
Hi, my name's James Prince. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I believe that Joe Wilson's controversy will not go away because it's meant for us to have discussion on race relations. While I do believe that people have a strong opinion on health care, I believe that that outburst was motivated by a racial tension.
You agree or disagree? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And while you're there, you can learn about the brave new health care bill being revealed by the Democrats. The brave and the curious and the wannabe wonks can read the full text of Max Baucus's bill. It's there in a link on our website. That's at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, remember, we want to hear from you about why you think the Joe Wilson controversy just won't go away. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway. Less than a year ago, a lot of people were looking forward to Barack Obama's post-racial society. That was then, and this is now.
I think an overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man, that he's African-American.
So much for the post-racial society, Jimmy Carter, at least so far. Or maybe we just hit a bump on the road to the post-racial world. Or does this all just come with the territory of Barack Obama's first term, a four-year national conversation about race? We'll find out that and more on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 17th. I'm Todd Zwillik in for John Hockenberry. This hour, we look at President Obama's healthcare media blitz. You'll have to work hard to avoid him on TV from now to the weekend. Plus, we'll test drive new software that tracks how much time we waste on our computers. And Takeaway music expert Terrence McKnight remembers Mary Travers of Peter, Paul & Mary. She died last night at age 72. But first, we take the temperature of the racial climate here at home. Joe Hicks is joining us. He's a community leader, activist, and talk show host on KFI Radio in Los Angeles. Joe, what does the latest volume of the debate and accusations of racism say about where we are in this country right now?
Well, Todd, I think you got it right. I think it is a bump in the road. I think this country is definitely heading in the direction of, an excellent kind of racial climate. It's been a long, you know, hard climb there. And I think two things are going on, basically, Todd. I think just on the streets, people are getting along fine. They might be talking about the kind of stuff that we hear Jimmy Carter talking about, but yet they get along fine with their next-door neighbor. It's, in, I think, in the world of punditry and commentary and politics where all of a sudden we see this new assertion that somehow we're in the midst of a resurgence of racism. I find it kind of interesting just a year after all this optimism over the the election of America's first black president. So All I right. think, you know, it's just kind of growing pains, I think.
All right. People getting along at home, but maybe not in politics. That's one take. Joe Hicks, stay with us. We'll continue the conversation with you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning. In the headlines, two key economic indicators are just out this morning. New home building is up to its highest level in 9 months, and new weekly jobless claims came in lower than expected. Connecticut police now have a man under arrest in the killing of a Yale graduate student. Her name is Annie Lay. Raymond Clark is a lab technician at the university. His bond has been set at $3 million. Wall Street gained more than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens today at 97.92. The S&P starts trading at 10.69, and the NASDAQ begins at 21.33. Controversy over Joe Wilson's outburst during the president's speech to Congress is not going away. Why do you think the Joe Wilson controversy is staying with us?
My name is Sarah. I'm calling from Massachusetts. I think the Joe Wilson issue is not going away because he continues to show zero humility and has turned this into a massive fundraising campaign. I'm an unlucky recipient of many of his and his wife's emails looking for money to capitalize on what he said.
Political capitalization to raise money or legitimate racial overtones remaining in our politics? 8778-MYTAKE or send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. I'd like to start out today by taking a look back in time. Let's go back to February of 08, when a young politician from Chicago was selling a message of hope and the dream of a post-racial America.
I am absolutely convinced that white, black, Latino, Asian people want to move beyond our divisions, and they want to join together in order to create a movement for change in this country.
Well, a year and a half later, in the middle of this debate about health care and our economy, we're still hearing messages like this one.
That racism still exists, and I think it's bubbled up to the surface because of a belief among many white people, not just in the South but around the country, that African Americans are not qualified to lead this great country. It's an abominable circumstance and grieves me and concerns me very deeply.
That, of course, was former President Jimmy Carter in an interview. He says we're not in a post-racial society. Well, frankly, is having a black president help to unify us, or is it just driving the racial divide deeper in this country? And more than that, why do charges and countercharges of racism keep coming up every couple of months? Is the presidency of Barack Obama going to be a four-year national argument about race and its place in our culture and in our politics? Well, back with us is Joe Hicks, a commentator for Pajamas Television, a community leader, and an activist and a talk show host on KFI Radio in Los Angeles. For more than 30 years, he's been an active figure on the local and national scene on issues related to civil rights and intergroup relations. We're also going to be joined by Mark Anthony Neal, who's a professor of African American Studies at Duke University. Welcome to you both. Joe Hicks, I want to start with you. The latest debate on health care and the staunch, sometimes vicious opposition to it, the you lie comment during the joint session, has sparked the latest round of discussions about race during this presidency. Do you think that's legitimate?
By and large, no. Listen, around the edges of any movement, the anti-war movement or this so-called Tea Party or the movement that exists around opposition to Obama's policies, that obviously is quite large. There were 100,000 people in the streets of Washington a week ago. But it's by and large political. At the edges are some pretty bizarre people. You got these birthers folk that refuse to accept the fact that Barack Obama is an American citizen and like to claim that he's some kind of secret Muslim and all this sort of thing. So, yeah, there's some crazies and wackos at the edges of this stuff. But by and large, what you're seeing is political opposition. Joe Wilson is a hardline Republican operative who sees fundamentally as his main job to take on Barack Obama every single day. So it's about politics and opposition to this president, by and large, because he's the head, titular head, if you will, of the Democratic Party, and they're taking that on in a very direct kind of way. I just find it astounding that Jimmy Carter, a year after this kind, 43% of all white Americans voted to elect a black president. And here we have
40% of registered voters voted, white voters voted for Jimmy Carter. That's right. A different distinction.
Mark Anthony Neal.
That's a different distinction.
Okay, Mark Anthony Neal.
That sounds like Mark Anthony Neal.
Yes, Mark Anthony Neal. Hang on one second. I want you to get in right here because I think Michael Steele, who's the chairman of the Republican National Committee and an African-American, agrees with Joe Hicks on this. Let's listen to Steele right now.
Well, what's the difference between booing the president when he's giving a State of the Union address, which happened to Bush, and this particular outburst from one congressman?
Mark Anthony Neal, what do you think?
I think, you know, the one thing that the right has done very successfully over the last two decades is that they've shifted the discourse, they've shifted the language. So in some ways, you know, decorum demands that, you know, even if you have some concerns about Barack Obama's race, it's never going to be directly addressed in that way. You know, they're never going to complain that, you know, the system is messed up now because we have a black president. You know, they've created a symbolism around language, you know, so that, you know, going back to Ronald Reagan in 1976, the idea of a welfare queen, we now in the culture hear the term welfare queen, and no one ever says we're talking about a black or Latino woman, but it's all understood that what that represents. So the language has shifted. So the old charges that, you know, what you're saying that is racist, I mean, the left really has to come up with new language to describe the tension of what's going on at this point in time. I think it's critical to understand that when we talk about the support for Barack Obama among white voters, right, the majority that votes for him is by and large clearly a multicultural, diverse, and younger majority that puts him in the office. There are lots of people in this country, black, white, or whatever ethnicity, that had opted out of the process and have long opted out of the process. So to talk about 40% of the whites who supported him, and you're talking about 40% of the registered white voters who supported him, there's still millions of people in this country who have opted out of the process, and these are the people that, by and large, are now taking to the streets and having a voice. I think it'd be interesting that when you talk about those 100,000 people that come to Washington, D.C., ask how many of them are registered voters.
Okay, Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African-American studies at Duke University. You mentioned the protests over the weekend in Washington, and I want to bring something up because I was walking around downtown over the weekend, and one of the people I was with was looking at the signs. Admittedly, this person is probably, I would imagine, on the liberal end of the spectrum, but said to me, you know, a lot of this doesn't seem to be about you're spending too much money, or I don't like the way you're overhauling healthcare, Barack Obama. A lot of this seems to be about who do you think you are? And that was the comment that was made to me. Who does this guy think he is? Now, that was very subjective from a friend of mine. But Joe Hicks, I want to know what you think about that perception that people at the protests or people who have the high volume or vitriol for the president.
Well, Todd, what you're again identifying are the wackos and crazies at the fringe of this stuff. Listen, if you had gone to the kind of anti-war demonstration of prevalence country a year ago, or gone to the protest outside of the Crawford Ranch that Cindy Sheehan had organized with banners identifying George Bush as Hitler, and then tried to characterize the entire protest group as being identified with those kind of placards and banners, you could have done the same thing. So it's really unfair, and it sort of tried to get inside the heads of a lot of folks. And Mark is talking about what he presumed to be disenfranchised voters. Listen, a lot of those voters a lot of people that were in the streets in D.C. formerly voted Republican. A lot of them have left the Republican Party. You know, so, you know, again, this attempt to get inside of white folks' heads and attribute all sorts of racial motives. So now we got to code language to try to figure out what do they really mean when they say X. You know, I mean, this is getting into kind of Orwellian kind of stuff here.
All right, Joe Hicks, let me get listeners in on this real quick because we want to hear from them. They've been responding to this issue as we've been asking.
Hi, this is Dan calling in from Boston. I think the Joe Wilson controversy is still going on, and mainly it's getting hyped up as the race angle, is because of the fact that almost any time if somebody's going to, you know, go against him, you know, that card's going to come out.
Mark Anthony Neal, there is a frustration among conservatives, and it's probably justified. They feel they can't voice reasonable or principled opposition to Barack Obama's policy decisions, sweeping policy moves, without being labeled racist now. They have a point, don't they?
I think they don't, because I think the Democratic Party and his, you know, combatants during the primary managed to do that without necessarily having to deal with Charles or racism. Of course, Bill Clinton dealt with something.
Oh, but they were.
Process.
Hang on, gentlemen. Hang on. Not everyone who criticizes, let's say, a $787 billion spending bill or a health care overhaul is necessarily doing it because of race.
No, I get that. I understand that. I absolutely understand it. But when I look at, for instance, Joe Wilson and his outbursts, I have a hard time. And again, we can only presume here, but I have a hard time that if it's a white body in that suit on that pulpit at that moment, that he's going to go to that level. All right. I think there becomes a different strategy within that context. And right, I can understand. Right. I clearly understand folks on the right who are frustrated with the fear, really, that they're going to be labeled as racist simply because they're being critical. But by the same token, they're also. So very often when you're talking about elected officials, they're also rolling hand in hand with pundits and media figures who clearly are pushing the race card around Barack Obama.
Joe Hicks, quickly, you think conservatives have a point in their frustration?
Yes, they do. And you know, it's clear that the left in this country wants to identify any kind of criticism of this president as being racist in form. And it didn't just happen since Obama has been in the White House. When McCain was campaigning, the Obama campaign tried desperately to label John McCain and the figures around him as having some kind of racial motivation, and much of the press releases out of the Obama camp directly attempted to do that.
And race, you know, race was part of the campaign. That's definitely
but
true.
What do you do with the criticisms directed towards Barack Obama by folks on the left?
All right, gentlemen.
Because clearly they're critiques that he is not left enough.
All right, well, gentlemen, we didn't think that we were going to come up with any good answers here. Just a good chance to check in on where the nation is in this struggle with race. I think one thing's clear. This is becoming a meme of the presidency of Barack Obama's first term. And you know, after Jeremiah Wright and Skip Gates' incident in Boston, the outcry over the street artist who painted Barack Obama in whiteface, and now Jimmy Carter's comments, this seems to be part of the package that comes along with Barack Obama's presidency. It just comes with the territory. I think we're on a merry-go-round with this, and it's going to go around a lot more times before it's over. Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African American Studies at Duke, and Joe Hicks, commentator at KFI Radio in Los Angeles. Thanks to you both for joining us for this important discussion. We appreciate it having you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Back once again is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Today, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission conducts its first public meeting. Now, what is the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, you may ask?
Well, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was established as a bipartisan commission to undertake a very important nonpartisan agenda, and that is to dig in and find the root causes of what led to the financial system meltdown in this country.
That was Commission Leader Phil Angelides earlier this summer. Louise, there were congressional hearings, and there are already groups out there investigating how the economic collapse happened. So what is the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission? Is this like the 9/11 Commission of Wall Street?
Some people are comparing it to that. People are also comparing it to the PCORA Commission, which was created back in the 30s during the Great Depression to look at what caused those problems in the stock market crash then. You know, it's unclear where they're going to focus. They were tasked by Congress to study 20 specific issues, which include everything from, you know, the credit rating agencies to the fancy securitized mortgage bonds that were created, to also how the current administration and the previous administration have handled the crisis once it sprung loose. So they have a broad mandate. One of the questions is, are they going to find anything new or come to conclusions that others haven't?
Anything we don't already know.
They won't be out with a report till the end of next year.
And you think they find anything we don't already know?
You know, I think what they might have is the benefit of a little more hindsight, because since they do not issue the report till the end of 2010, we're going to get a lot more information about the recovery. In particular, we're going to have more insights on President Obama's administration's work to end the crisis. And so they may have the benefit of hindsight that the kind of quick observers haven't had.
Benefit of hindsight, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and finance, economic and finance contributor here at The Takeaway. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island.
We now turn to some sad news for music fans around the world, particularly fans of a certain generation. Mary Travers, best known for her work as a member of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary, died last night at the age of 72 of leukemia. For a look at her music and its impact on an entire generation is Takeaway music correspondent Terrence McKnight. Terrence is host of Evening Music on member station WNYC here in New York. Terrence, good morning.
Good morning, Todd.
Terrence, can you help us understand a little bit the impact Peter, Paul, and Mary had on the counterculture movement of the 60s?
Well, I think the folk music scene here in America had a great opportunity to be relevant in the 60s because of the civil rights movement. And so in order for that movement to really take hold, all Americans or Americans from diverse backgrounds had to be willing to shift. And so there needed to be a unified voice. And what Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Joan Baez, and Woody Guthrie, and Harry Belafonte, all of these folk singers did was give voice. They gave voice to the suffering of women and minorities and all of the injustice that was going on in this country. And so for somebody like Mary Travers, who was, you know, slender and blonde and young, she didn't really have to align herself with the downtrodden, but she did appeal to many people who may have found Dr. King's voice too threatening. So she, through this music and through with Peter, Paul, and Mary, they were really able to speak to many people in the country.
You know, the only group, Terrence McKnight, that I can think of in recent memory that had as much earnestness about social justice and politics as Peter, Paul, and Mary was Fugazi, which is a punk band from Washington, D.C., known to a lot of people in an underground way, and they're not even playing anymore. I don't know that there's a band around today that used music in such an earnest way as Peter, Paul, and Mary did.
And that's one thing that people always say about Mary Travers was her authenticity and her honesty in her music. In fact, one of her colleagues said that he didn't know if she was capable of lying. She always told the brutal truth.
Well, they took a stand on the civil rights movement, that's for sure. Let's take a listen to a famous hit from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Of course, Blowing in the Wind, written by Bob Dylan. Terrence, it's not the only Bob Dylan song they did. How much do you think Peter, Paul, and Mary contributed to Bob Dylan's emergence and his importance to the protest movement and also his importance as an artist?
Well, Peter, Paul, and Mary made Bob Dylan a star. I mean, this record, when it came out in 63, sold, you know, like 300,000 copies in the first week. And it reached, you know, number one on or number two on Billboard, and it's sold over a million copies. And you know, when you introduced the segment, Todd, you talked about generational. Yeah. Well, some of these songs I heard in January at the inauguration of the president, and you had, you know, old folks, you had young folks, people from various generations singing these same folk songs that a group like Peter, Paul, and Mary really made famous and brought to the nation.
They remained as performers up until probably just a couple of years ago. I remember seeing them. Was it nostalgia that kept Peter, Paul, and Mary around like it would, you know, the Smothers Brothers, or was it a deeper connection, do you think, to their music and what it meant to that generation?
Yeah, it was nostalgia, but it was also their cause. You know, Mary talked about having a responsibility in her community and using that voice for that responsibility.
Did she remain active even after the apex of the group?
She did. And I mean, this group, they were, I guess, most relevant between 61 and 71. And then they all did kind of solo careers. But they came back together in 78 and started doing a bunch of concerts. And they took up causes not only here in America, but around the world for apartheid, for in South America. So they took up the cause of injustice around the world and remained relevant even through her bout with leukemia.
You know, I read this morning something that shocked me, that when Mary Travers was originally hired for the band, she was hired because she was, quote, pretty. What do you think? She's not the first pop star to be hired because she was pretty, but she became so much more. It is some blonde irony, isn't it?
Well, I think the manager was looking for somebody pretty. He was looking for somebody smart, and he was looking for a group that was really cohesive. And with these three, he found that.
Terrence McKnight, Takeaway music correspondent, joining us to review a little bit the life and work of Mary Travers. Travers, a member of Peter, Paul, and Mary, died of leukemia just yesterday at 72. Mary Travers and the group who helped bring Bob Dylan to the fore. This is The Times They Are Changing, originally written by Bob Dylan.
Can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are a change.
Coming up, the president's ongoing battle with the media, trying to get control of the media, rather, with a blitz on health care coming up this weekend and coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Coming up, President Obama is going on an all-out media blitz to pitch his health care plan. More on that in just a few minutes. Right now, Femi Okay is here for a check on some of the day's top news stories.
In the headlines at 28 minutes to the top of the hour, the Obama administration is abandoning an Eastern European missile defense plan that's been a major irritant in relations with Russia. The BBC's Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin spoke to us earlier about the reaction from Russia's ambassador to NATO.
He's saying that this is a breakthrough in relations between Washington and Moscow.
President Obama is expected to make a full statement on the plan later today. In the United States, the president will attend a healthcare rally today at the University of Maryland. It's just one part of his push to promote an overhaul of the U.S. system. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus will try to convince fellow Democrats that his health reform package will work. And overseas in international news, six Italian NATO soldiers died today when a suicide car bomb hit their convoy in the Afghan capital, Kabul. A Taliban spokesman is claiming responsibility for the attack. And those are stories we're watching today. Todd.
Thank you, Femi. Well, if you turn on the television between tomorrow and Monday, you are likely to see the President of the United States. He's going on an all-out media blitz. This weekend, the President plans to go on five political talk shows ahead of the UN General Assembly here in New York. Did you know there were five? There are. He's hitting all of them. But the question remains, is the President hitting back hard enough? Could he possibly hit any harder is another question. And what does he have to do to get health care reform passed already? For the answers to some of those questions, we speak with James Marone, a political science professor at Brown University and author of The Heart of Power, Health Care and Politics in the Oval Office. Jim Marone, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Todd. Good to be here.
So five political talk shows, David Letterman, a couple of rallies ahead of the UN. The president must really think he has a big job ahead of him. This is an all-out blitz.
He's got a tough job, although some Democrats are saying, you know, thank heavens, where were you? And now here he is. What he's got to do is rally his base, get his base excited, because what he's asking the Democrats in Congress to do, and remember, the real audience is about 300 people in Congress, and he's asked them to stake the reputation of their party, the future in a party, on a bill that's a little too liberal for a lot of the conservative Democrats and a little too conservative for a lot of the liberal Democrats. So he needs to stiffen their spine by filling their ears with yes, we can, the old base getting excited. But it's a very tough job, given how both sides think, gee, this is a little too centrist for us.
Interesting to me, the dual strategy of five political talk shows on Sunday, watched pretty much only by the wonkheads like me and probably you, not a big audience, but then David Letterman, watched by a gigantic audience. And that's good turf for the president. He does have a good sense of humor, and gosh darn it, people like him, to borrow a phrase from a Democratic senator. It's good ground for him.
Yeah, he's spending all his political capital, but that's a really good point, Todd, about the insider baseball. Really, this game is now inside the Beltway. This game is now 400 people. And the real test, that Obama now faces is how good a lobbyist is he? How good is he at twisting arms of his own party to get this bill through?
And then
the
what's
Republicans
the...
have staked their ground. We know where they
sure,
are.
Sure, sure. We do know where they are. And what is the late night comedy angle of this? I mean, this gets people reminded that they want change, I guess, that they like the president, and gets them to do what? Email and call their members of Congress?
Exactly. Members of Congress have to remember that this is a formidable political force. The most influential and powerful Democrat that they've seen in many, many years. And Obama's got to remind them, you guys think you have a future as a majority party, you better stick with me. That's his job right now. And so far, the first indications coming out of Congress are that he's pretty good. Every time someone steps out of line, a day later they say, well, maybe we can work out a compromise. That's beginning to suggest this guy's pretty good behind the scenes, too. And I should add, Todd, that he has one great ace that's been given him, and that's someone shouting, Joe Wilson shouting, you're a liar. That's probably helped them more than anything else.
Differentiated them from the staunch opposition.
But Obama's job is clear. He's got to get a bunch of people of Congress convinced that his leadership is something they want to follow.
All right, Jim Marrone, political science professor at Brown University and author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, giving us a read on the president's media blitz, a rally today, appearance on 5 political talk shows on Sunday, and an appearance on Late Night with David Letterman to do some laughs and a little bit of personality. Thanks a lot. Well, let's turn now from healthcare to another major policy issue that's coming up after they get health care done, if they get it done. That's the climate change debate. Can you guess what this is, folks? I didn't know what it was either at first. That's the sound of ice breaking in the Arctic Circle. Today, representatives of 17 countries meet in Washington, D.C. for a major forum on energy and climate. The countries that are meeting are some of the world's biggest polluters. The forum is one of a group of meetings leading up to the Copenhagen Conference in December. That Copenhagen Conference is slated to create a new global policy to replace the Kyoto Protocol after it expires in 2012, and which, of course, the United States did not sign on to. I'm here now with David Biel, Associate Editor for Scientific American. David, another meeting of international climate groups, and people kind of glaze over a little bit, but it's a little more important than it sounds because they're looking to the U.S. for leadership here.
That's correct. And as you noted, healthcare is kind of eating up all the air in the room, but climate change is kind of the ball that's rolling right behind healthcare. And President Obama has said on the campaign trail that this is a top priority for him. And he will have the chance to negotiate with his fellow big polluters on Tuesday here in New York.
Well, the 17-nation forum on energy and climate has to be a little bit discouraged. You know, when climate change passed the House, albeit narrowly, everybody was very encouraged. And they may get it done this fall in the Senate. And a lot of people are saying probably not. There's got to be some discouraging signs.
Yes, it's a little unclear whether they can get through health care, you know, financial reform, and then get to climate change, all of which are obviously very hot topics.
So what does that mean if you're an international leader? You're from France, you're from Germany and Italy, Japan, countries that are on board with international agreements on climate change, and you're looking to this president who's not delivering for one reason or another. What's in their minds?
Well, it's not all terrible news, because basically you've got this new club, which was actually partially started by our old friend President Bush, of the world's biggest polluters. And what might surprise you is that the biggest polluters in the world, China and the U.S., obvious, Indonesia and Brazil round out that list. All 4 of those countries will be at this meeting. If the 4 of them get together and come up with any kind of a deal, a side deal, just a statement of principle, that's a big step forward on climate change.
All right. Looking forward to a possible international agreement on climate change. David Biello, Associate Editor for Scientific American. Thanks for joining us. Well, coming up, your email, your IM, Twitter, Facebook, in my case, BlackBerry, they can all take a big toll on productivity. But we'll learn how technology can help us avoid some of those pitfalls. We've got a little bit of automated willpower coming up. That's in just 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Connecticut police now have a man under arrest in the killing of a Yale graduate student. Her name is Annie Lay. Raymond Clark is a 24-year-old lab technician at the university. His bond has been set at $3 million. Here to tell us more of the details and how students are reacting as they head to class this morning, we have Thomas Kaplan, editor of the Yale Daily News. Thomas, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So yesterday, Raymond Clark was a, quote, person of interest. Today he's under arrest. Why the change?
Well, the change is pretty simple. The answer appears to be DNA, according to our sources. The police yesterday, when they took Mr. Clark in, collected DNA samples, hundreds of different samples, and the results apparently tie him to Annie Lay. So he was taken back into custody at approximately 8 a.m. this morning after a warrant was signed for his arrest, and he's now gone from person of interest to an accused killer.
Are police sharing any details of the nature of the crime, why they took DNA?
They are not, and the warrant for his arrest has been sealed. But we did learn from the medical examiner yesterday that the cause of death was strangulation. So that's the one detail we know about what happened. But aside from that, all other details are being withheld.
What do we know about the relationship between Lay and Clark while she was alive?
Well, that's a good question. The police chief, the New Haven police chief this morning, described the murder as an instance of workplace violence, said that there was absolutely no basis to any suggestion that there was some sort of intimate relationship between Mr. Clark, who is also engaged to be married, as Annie Lay had been. We don't know what type of dispute could have caused this or what might have led to it, but it's being described as a workplace violence type of incident.
And so a murder like this of a student, allegedly by another young person at least, who worked right around the campus, has to be shocking, of course, for students around there over the last 24 hours, and this has become such a huge story. What reaction are you hearing from kids on campus?
Well, I think there are sort of two ways to look at it. I mean, one, certainly there is shock that, you know, a member of the Yale community would do something like this, allegedly, to, you know, another Yalee. I think that's just something really hard to get your head around. On the other hand, I think to some extent, you know, the police have tried to reassure students and local residents over the past week that this was not a random crime. This was not a robbery on the street gone wrong, and that it's not any indication that the campus is unsafe or the city is unsafe. So looking at it that way, I think it's reassuring to some extent. But overall, I mean, this is just the type of thing that no one is prepared to try to deal with.
And you have to be asking yourself why this has become a national news story. Why do you think? Is it because she was due to be married or because she was pretty or a Yalee or all three? Why a national news story now?
You know, it's a combination of all those factors. I think any type of crime or scandal on an Ivy League campus, particularly Yale or Harvard, always has legs to become a national story.
Because it's ironic that somebody who's Ivy League would be the victim or the perpetrator of a crime?
Well, to some extent, I think there's also kind of a fascination with sort of the Ivy League culture, and any type of scandal at a campus like this, at a place like this, draws headlines. But I think another element here that's important is just the you know, very peculiar and unfortunate nature of the crime, the fact that Annie Lay was about to be married, the fact that, you know, she literally vanished, you know, in this building, was captured going in on security cameras and then went missing.
All right.
And
all right, Thomas,
I think that's what's so shocking.
Thanks, Thomas. Thomas Kaplan, editor of the Yale Daily News, bringing us up to speed on the arrest of Raymond Clark for the murder of Annie Lay at Yale.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, why can't you stay productive at work? Your computer might be part of the problem and part of the solution. More on that in just a few minutes. We're also talking about the controversy over Joe Wilson. Why do you think it's just not going away?
This is Ben of New York. The reason this Joe Wilson topic doesn't go away is because the media keeps bringing it up, like yourself.
Interesting point. Hopefully, we're covering it in a way that's constructive. We sure hope so. Tell us what you think at 8778-MYTAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, Femi Oke is here with a check on the headlines.
Just like to scratch out Joe Wilson from the news headlines there. Make everybody happy. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. The U.S. is canceling a planned missile defense program in Eastern Europe. Russia calls the move a breakthrough in U.S.-Russia relations. The Obama administration isn't giving giving specifics until next hour, but the Czech Prime Minister says that President Obama told him that the original plan is scrapped. Six NATO troops are dead after a suicide car bomb in Afghanistan. The blast happened near the American embassy in Kabul. The Taliban claim responsibility for the attack on the military convoy. Back in the US, Wall Street is reacting to two key economic indicators just out this morning. There's some hopeful news in there. Some new jobless claims dropped unexpectedly, and home building jumped up to its highest level in 9 months. In Colorado, federal agents have been carting away boxes of evidence at the home of a suburban Denver man who's been suspected of being linked to Al-Qaeda. The FBI say this is linked to the raids earlier this week in New York City. And finally, fans are mourning the loss of Mary Travers. The Peter, Paul and Mary star died last night, aged 72. The band reached millions with songs, including Leaving on a Jet Plane and Blowing in the Wind. And those are stories we're watching today. Todd.
Thanks, Femi. We're talking about technology this morning, as we do every Thursday. Today, focus and distraction. You're at work trying to write a proposal, and you're being sucked in by YouTube highlights of Tom Brady's game winner against the Bills, or new pictures of your friend's baby shower on Facebook, or in my case, your Twitter feed, and nothing gets done. It's the curse of the online distraction. Most of us know all about it. Now, there are a series of new applications that act as enforcement mechanisms against that curse. Think of it as kind of automated willpower. They intend to make you less distracted and more productive. Farhad Manju writes about technology for Slate.com and has looked at a number of these new applications in an article for our partner, The New York Times. Also, Tony Wright is the founder and CEO of Rescue Time, a company that makes productivity and analytic tools, the kinds of things we're talking about right now. Hi, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hello. Thanks a lot.
Tony, let me come right to you. You've got some pretty stunning data to start off with from Rescue Time on how people spend their time, or should I say waste their time, on their computer. What do we know from your data?
Well, I mean, to preface all this, I think it's important to note that this is data from all people who are actually trying to improve their productivity. So I think we can guess that these people are slightly more productive than average. But the big stat that always jumps out at me is that the average instant message user switches to an instant message window 77 times per day. That's the big one. And the other sort of nightmare stat for me is the average user is has about 35 to 38% of their time allocated towards communication apps. That includes email and instant message.
Some of this being what you're supposed to be doing at work, at least according to your boss, and some of this being wasting time.
Right, exactly. And you know, communication is, just because you're getting an email from a coworker doesn't mean it's not wasting time. I think there's a big problem in that we've reduced the incremental cost of communicating with a coworker to zero. You don't have to get up. You don't have to put a stamp on anything. You just press a button, and all of a sudden you're interrupting your coworker. So this is, I think, you know, it's strange. You know, obviously Facebook and YouTube get the big billing, but I think one of the things that saps productivity more than anything else is coworkers interrupting each other when they could just be, you know, letting each other focus and kind of saving up for an actual meeting or a real slightly longer discussion.
So there may be a premium on hand for actually blocking out your coworkers while you're sitting across the office space from them. Well, Farhad Manju of Slate, you installed Rescue Time on your machine as part of your review of a whole bunch of these sort of willpower substitutes. What did you learn about your own computer habits?
I've been using Rescue Time for some time now, and I remember when I first installed it, and then sort of a week later it had monitored my activity, and I took a look at the various graphs that they have. I was very shocked. I mean, as Tony says, you learn a lot about yourself from watching what you do on your computer all day. I noticed that I had been, you know, I'm sort of an online news junkie, and so I had been reading Slate, where I work. I remember there was a...
Sure you were. You think your editor's listening.
Slate, the New York Times, basically every other news site you can think of. I had been on there, you know, many, many more hours than I had been actually working per day.
So what you're saying, Farhad, you're saying, though, that Rescue Time on your computer, it was surprising to you. It not only monitors your habits, but spits back to you the evidence. Here's how you're spending your time, Mr. Manju.
Yeah, I've heard that when you try to quit smoking, one of the things they make you do is sort of look at like all your cigarette butts in your ashtray and see, yeah, and sort of feel guilty about it. This is like that. You feel really guilty when you look at all of the evidence of like you're goofing off.
Okay, so that's sort of guilt by automation, letting you know what you've been doing and maybe you're doing the wrong thing. But there's also sort of enforced willpower. Farhad, let me stick with you. You've reviewed a whole bunch of other programs, Leech Block and Freedom, a couple of others that can actually do the willpower for you. They can block these things. How do they work?
Yeah, so the idea is you know, using a program like Rescue Time or just your sense of where you're wasting your time, you figure out kind of the bad websites, the sites where you are likely to sort of get carried away and waste a lot of time. And so, for example, a program like Leech Block, which is an add-on to Firefox, the web browser, you tell it where, you know, you give it a list of sites and you sort of give it a time limit. Say, you know, I want to only be able to check Twitter 5 minutes per hour. And after that 5 minutes is up, it blocks you and you can't go to that site again. And there are various programs like this that you basically tell them where you're not allowed to go, and you tell them, you know, during the time, which times of the day you're not allowed to go, and they stop you.
Tony, right, these things stop me, but then what prevents me? Let's say I block Twitter and I block YouTube and I block Facebook. I know myself. I won't go on those sites, but I will use the time I would have spent on YouTube going to something else that I wasn't going to before, just other websites probably or other ways to waste time, sort of the path of least resistance. How do you prevent alternative time wasting?
You know, that's something we recently, and this is the first time I've told anyone about this, we just soft launched a very similar feature to Leech Block where you can do this. And that was our frustration, is that maintaining this mammoth list of sites that could be distracting is really, really hard. So what we do is actually block by category, so or even level of productivity. So we can say, block all distracting sites for X time.
What is the definition of a distracting site?
Well, I mean, that's something that you have the ability to control, but because we're doing this in the cloud and there's a ton of users basically contributing to this list of distracting sites, basically everyone is sort of helping everyone else out, and we have a fairly complete list. So, and obviously, if you work at Twitter, Twitter might not be a distracting site for you, so you might want to take that off the list and kind of whitelist it. But I think the sort of category blocking is a lot more effective than that list, because, right, and I think it's important to note that you don't want to destroy the concept of leisure surfing. There's actually studies that show that leisure surfing is a critical part of productivity, that you need that sort of, you know, couple of minutes of break time to sort of reset your brain and get back on task. You just got to have sort of systems or software that sort of avoids binging is what we want to avoid.
Okay, well, Farhad, let me turn to you. Once you put these enforcement mechanisms on your computer, did they enforce discipline, or did you find yourself getting distracted for things maybe away from the machine?
Yeah, I found that when I had blocked everything, if I had blocked something that I often escape to, like Twitter or Facebook, I found myself, you know, escaping in other ways, like getting up from the computer and taking a walk or eating. I found myself eating a lot of snacks.
So rescue various time leads to obesity. That's the takeaway.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Tony. No, but it's interesting. You do have the path of least resistance. We maybe spend time one way or wasted another way. Farhad Manju writes about technology for Slate.com. He's written an article for our partner, the New York Times, about a new series of productivity applications for your computer. Tony Wright makes those applications. He's founder and CEO of Rescue Time, a company that makes productivity and analytical tools. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll link to a number of these new productivity applications on our website, including Rescue Time, a version of which you can download for free. That's at thetakeaway.org. Well, we're also hearing from you because we're asking, why do you think the Joe Wilson controversy isn't going away?
This is Kathy from Manhattan. I think the controversy isn't going away because the volume of craziness in the country, evidenced by the organized town meetings, protests, the birthers, and so forth, has finally risen to such a volume that it burst out into Congress, and I think that it couldn't be ignored.
And does racism have a part in all this? We've got an interesting take from you.
My name is Michael Canella from Detroit. The thing that I really find interesting about the racial conversation is how much it seems to resemble the Balkan situation, a situation in which you had pundits, political figures, for the sake of their own opportunism, magnifying the differences in people that had gotten along fairly well with their neighbors.
8778MYTAKE. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.